Good evening. My name is Whitney Moyer, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum. On behalf of the Phi Beta Kappa Visiting Scholar Program, the Phi Beta Kappa of Dickinson College, and the Clark Forum, I would like to welcome you to tonight's lecture, Transforming Self-Interest: How Organizations Provoke Social Justice Commitments. Do organizations change a person's beliefs? To what extent can an organization socialize its members? Socialization is part of the process of becoming a member of and fitting into a group. Usually, members are demanded to change their preferences and values to match the norms of the organization. The process of socialization may range from the self-conscious to the subconscious. However, the question remains, why do people violate reason and take part in irrational organizations? Voluntary organizations vary significantly in the demands they make of their members. Some religious denominations require orthodoxy, while others tolerate, even encourage, non-traditional behaviors. The same process is observed among terrorist groups, political organizations, and labor unions, in which organizational membership can change the beliefs of constituents regarding the nature of the world and subsequently provoke new preferences. Tonight's discussion, led by Margaret Levy, investigates the way in which organizational membership changes beliefs about the nature of the world and provokes a new set of values and preferences, with a focus on left-wing Longshore Union members. Currently, Margaret Levy is the Jerry L. Bacharach Professor of International Studies in the Department of Political Science at the University of Washington in Seattle. She is also the Director of CHAOS, Comparative Historical Analysis of Organizations and States. In 1999, she became the General Editor of Cambridge Studies in Comparative Politics, and she serves as Editor of the Annual Review of Political Science. In addition, she served as the president of the American Political Science Association from 2004 to 2005. In 1968, Levy earned her BA from Bryn Mawr College, and in 1974, she earned her PhD from Harvard University. Her fellowships include the Woodrow Wilson, German Marshall, and the Center for Advanced Study of Behavioral Sciences. At this time, please turn off all cell phones and pagers. In addition, please hold any questions until the end of the presentation, when there will be a brief question and answer session. Because we are recording this event, and out of courtesy to the hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before you ask your questions. And now, please join me in welcoming Margaret Levy.
Thank you very much, Whitney. I want to tell you a little bit about the sources of this project before I tell you what it exactly is. There are really two sources. The first one comes from my experience as being something called the Harry Bridges Chair in Labor Studies. I know you're supposed to hold questions, but I'm sort of curious, how many of you have a clue, or actually know, who Harry Bridges was? Anybody? Harry Bridges was an Australian who came to the United States and became the chief organizer of the longshore workers, that is, the dock workers, on the west coast of the U.S. He orchestrated a major strike in 1934 that closed down ports up and down the whole west coast of the U.S. and led the union, which became a breakaway union from the larger Longshore Union, the whole National Longshore Union, became the West Coast Union, the International Longshore and the Left Coast Union, as it became, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. He was accused by the federal government of being a communist on many occasions. He, in fact, claimed to hold communist principles but to not be a member of the Communist Party. It was taken to the Supreme Court at least twice, maybe three times, as well as his efforts to become a citizen of the United States. He won on every count. His third marriage was to a Japanese American who had been in our internment camps of the Japanese. When they went to Reno to get married, they were denied a marriage certificate because of miscegenation, because they were marrying across races. So they took that to the Supreme Court and changed the law for the United States. I think they changed to state law and then it went up. So he was a union leader who his members believed had changed the condition of being what they had called themselves before, wharf rats, the lowest of the low on the totem pole, into being lords of the dock. He ran the process by which technology came to the longshore profession on the West Coast, containerization. And the longshore, who were the 34 men, they were all men, who had been part of the big strike and then had been part of the union for a long time, ended up with really, really good incomes and pensions. And when he died in 1990, they decided that they would institute, he was committed to education, for using work to be something that would give people the capacity to do other things in their lives, to have mobility. And when he died in 1919, the longshore union members, the pensioners, the retired members of the longshore, decided that they would institute a chair in his name. And they decided to do it at the University of Washington, even though he had been living in San Francisco most of his adult life, because during the big strike in 1934, the president of Berkeley had allowed the football players to be strike breakers, and the president of the University of Washington refused to allow them to do that. And so we got this chair, and we rotated it. Harry Bridges didn't believe in what was called the standing man. People should rotate jobs so that everybody had more or less equality of income, and we rotated the chair, and I became the third holder of it. Became fascinated with this union and this history, about which I knew a little, but not a lot, and instituted a project to understand its history and to understand something about the nature of its really quite incredible rank and file democracy. And the puzzle of Bridges being president for approximately 40 years, actually for 40 years, and yet there was in many ways this rank and file democracy. So it became a big student project to really uncover the nature of the rank and file democracy. And I'll come back to that as I talk. So that was one impulse, was to just sort of figure out this union. And as I began to think about it more and to learn more about it and learn from the students what they were uncovering about this union and the nature of it, I realized there was a really interesting issue that was a deep social science issue that this gave me a capacity to explore. And that's the issue that Whitney really just addressed, about the ways in which organizational cultures get formed, the way in which leadership plays a role in actually transforming the preference orderings that people might have, and that provokes or evokes from people a commitment to things that they, beyond their narrow economic self-interest or their material concerns. So I decided that would be really interesting to find out whether what the process was, what the mechanisms were that actually produced that kind of, if there really, one, was there really a transformation? And two, what produced that kind of transformation of interest or preferences so that people made commitments beyond themselves? One of my friends has called this project the Lenin problem, after V.I. Lenin and What Is to Be Done, his book about organizing workers to engage in class-conscious activities in 1907 or so when the book was published. And I applied to the National Science Foundation for money for this project under that title. I was given the money, quite a bit of money actually, but they changed the title of the project. They call it Cooperation, I forget what they call it, anyway, sacrifice and cooperation or something. I still call it the Lenin problem. So what is the Lenin problem? Let me just start by laying that out and then move into the nature of the study, which goes beyond the ILWU, the Longshore Union, and hopefully is transportable beyond unions and to thinking about organizations more generally, to thinking about governments, to thinking about polities, to thinking about a whole range of things. Again, this is a question, if we can figure out what the mechanisms are, we might be able to see whether they're at work in other kinds of situations. What the Lenin problem is that he looked around, wasn't a particularly rational choice theory in our lingo, but he looked around and he realized that workers were economistic, was the term that he used. That is, that they focused only on their material goals, only on their wages, hours, and benefits, that they thought about that in the context of their work and the context of what was beginning to be a unionization movement in Russia at that time. But they only thought about those things that would serve them individually or serve their families. It was very hard for them to think beyond their workplace or to think about larger sets of communities, let alone class, and thinking about organizing. I mean, obviously, Lenin was interested in developing revolution. So his question was, how do you transform economistic workers into a class-conscious political organization? And his answer to that question, the answer that he posed but didn't particularly practice in his own political practice, was that you educate the workers through an all-union, an all-worker newspaper that began to link their interests to each other, gave them information about the world. And you did it by leadership that was actually, because being a member of the Communist Party was illegal at that time, had to be very secret leadership. It had to be cells that nobody quite knew existed. So his answer, though it was an answer, ended up not really helping us very much. Nobody quite knew what to do with those answers, and when the revolution actually came about, it wasn't because of Lenin's solution to the Lenin problem. Now, if we think about unions and begin to try to figure out what's going on in unions and other organizations, unions become a very nice way to study this problem of how you transform these particularistic and economistic interests into something larger. The presumption, particularly in unions, is that the individuals who are members of them are narrowly rational and that the organizations encourage that. That is, that they only are concerned about economic costs and benefits, what's going to serve them, their material interests. So what accounts for those who act differently than that? What beliefs and preferences guide those choices? How are they formed? How are they maintained and reproduced? That's what I'm trying to study. Now, if we think about the Longshore Union, the ILWU, on the west coast of the US, and indeed its counterpart in Australia, and these are only two examples of unions that are like this, we see that these are union, that the aggregation of the members, the culture of being in that union, is that you give up time and money, you get good wages, you get good hours, you transform from a wharf rat to lords of the dock, but you give up time and money to fight on behalf of social justice causes, from which you can expect no particular individual return. And I'll give you a couple of examples of what this union has done. It often closes the ports and thus loses income. It doesn't get paid. The members don't get paid when they don't work. Employers do have that right, after all. It closed the ports and thus lost money. Here's a historical example. In 1938, both in Australia and in the US, in the west coast of the US, the ports were closed to protest the shipment of scrap iron, or pig iron, to Japan. The Longshore argued that this was material that would be turned into materiel, that it would be turned into armaments that would then come back and be used by the Japanese in what they saw as the coming war, what became World War II. But this is a very odd thing for a union to do. What does this have to do with their wages, hours, and working conditions? Or their benefits? This is an issue of national policy, right? So the union is saying, we have to take a stand on this important national issue, and they did. More recently, in the US, we've seen the ports closed to protest the death sentence of Mumia Abu-Jamal in 1999. Again, what does that have to do with them as workers in the ports? Nothing. And in Australia, we see longshore workers, dock workers, as they're called there, refusing to load sheep, live sheep, onto ships that are going to go to Saudi Arabia, where they will be slaughtered. The reason is they'll load dead sheep, but they won't load live sheep. The reason is that they are in a coalition with a group of people who are concerned about animal rights, that the way in which the sheep are slaughtered in Saudi Arabia is, the word can't be inhumane. In, what's the word? Well, that it's not a good way to slaughter animals. It's not a nice way to slaughter animals. Again, what does that have to do with their position as longshore workers? These are just, I could give you many more examples. And there's a continuum of examples that range from things where you could see it might be in their interest, or they're supporting other unions that are trying to organize, to things of the sort that I've given you, where it's clearly has to do with some kind of political or social justice commitments. Now, what I want to argue is that in these cases, something's happened to the beliefs of the people who are involved in the union. And I want to try to figure out how those beliefs change and what the factors are that do that. My argument is that, I'll use social science language here, my dependent variable is the revealed group behavior of the labor unions, particularly whether the union shows a willingness or not to engage in political social activities that do not have obvious payoffs to the membership in terms of wages, hours, and working conditions. As I continue in this talk, I'm going to argue that the following mechanisms seem to produce that behavior. One of the most important is principled leadership, and I'm going to elaborate what I mean by that, that often ideological at the beginning, that takes strong commitments to its principles and carries them out even when it's against their own self-interest. It requires interdependent workers, workers who feel that their fates are tied with each other, and so become a kind of community or develop a kind of solidarity with each other. They're concerned with each other's well-being. It requires a learning process, back to the Lenin problem, but I'm going to try to give some meat to these bones. A learning process that changes beliefs, activates norms, and provokes preferences. It changes knowledge about the nature of the injustices in the world. Again, I'll make that concrete. One of the old-timers, pensioners, that I interviewed in Australia, we were doing a group interview, and their union president during the crucial period that I was studying was actually a member of the Communist Party, Big Jim Healey. And after we'd had this group discussion about their experiences in the union during the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, this guy followed me out and he said, "I just want you to know I never bought that communist stuff. It just went right over my head. I didn't care about it. You know, all this stuff about ownership of the means of production, I don't." He said, "But when they came and told me about those, the Indonesian rebellion and those poor people trying to fight the colonial power, and that we were allowing ships to go to break up that revolution, I couldn't stand that. That's just not right." Right? So the process of being engaged in this union allowed him to learn about things in the world that then activated a sense of justice. It also, I think, a learning process that's crucial to this story is a process that changes the beliefs about what goals are accessible. You may care about social justice, but think, "I can't do that through this union. I can't do it at all. I have no power." So something happens within the union that makes people believe that these goals are, in fact, something they can fight for, and that it's okay to fight for that, and that they won't be killed, possibly, for fighting for those. And finally, the fourth mechanism I want to emphasize. So I've talked about principled leadership, the interdependence of the workers and learning. I want to emphasize something that I've argued in earlier work that I've done, which is the notion of contingent consent. That is, that you'll go along with what's being demanded of you under certain conditions, which have to do with the quality of the production, of how fair that particular leadership is, what other people are doing. You don't want to be the only person doing it. That you will actually support the leadership contingently as long as it meets certain conditions and standards. You'll consent, contingently consent with the organizational culture. And what we find, at least in the unions that have social justice commitments, is that just as that example I gave you of the guy who didn't believe in communism, not all the people have the same beliefs or the same ideologies, but they nearly all go along with the leadership and its demands. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about the study itself, because it's not just about longshore workers. I look at three unions, which I've divided into two kinds. They're the social movement unions, or these more ideological unions. And they're also what are much more common in the United States, what in the labor studies we call business unions. These are unions that feel that their job, and it's not the wrong thing to feel, this is part of their job, obviously, is to make sure that workers get better wages, hours, and working conditions, and anything beyond that is ridiculous, doesn't matter. That's not part of what a union is all about. So my example of the social movement unions, or the unions with social justice commitments, are longshore unions, obviously, in Australia and the US, and also one of the Teamster locals in the 1930s, the Minneapolis Teamsters local, which was destroyed. My example of the business unions are the other Teamster locals and the Teamster Union as a whole. I do a study of paired locals within these three unions, which made somewhat different choices so that I can hold certain kinds of institutional and demographic variables constant. So for the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, I compare Seattle and Tacoma. Seattle was part of the ILWU. Tacoma refused to become part of the ILWU until the late 1950s, actually. I look at Minneapolis, Detroit, and Seattle locals of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters from the 1930s till about the 1960s. That's about the area I'm studying with all of these, at least in the historical part. And with the Waterside Workers Federation, which is the longshore in Australia, I look at Melbourne and Sydney. Poor me to have to go to Melbourne and Sydney. Anybody who's been to Australia knows that's really hard work. Okay, I've already told you something about the Longshore Union, about the ILWU and the nature of bridges. What I haven't told you is that, or emphasized sufficiently, is that we did find that this is an amazing rank and file democracy, that people really participated in the union, at least up until relatively recently, at least in the longshore division. They voted, they got involved, they made policy, they hit the mic. I'll show you hitting the mic in a minute. And they made strong social commitments. The Teamsters, the Detroit local, was Hoffa's local, and it was he ran it. I mean, there was no participation. That was a local that had been put in receivership by the International and given to Hoffa. So there wasn't participation. They just did what he said. The Seattle local was run by Dave Beck, who was, who you probably never heard of, but who was also a very important Teamster leader, was Hoffa's predecessor as president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, international president, also his predecessor in going to jail, which is why Hoffa became president, because Beck was sent to jail. So Hoffa, before he went to jail, became the president. Beck died in his bed as opposed to in a cement something somewhere underground. But and he ran. He didn't have a union. The local was not under receivership, but he clearly ran it very top down, and we're doing detailed studies of that local right now. Very talented undergraduate is doing that work. The Waterside Workers Federation was very similar to the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. But whereas the ILWU was disproportionately, at least initially, composed of people of Scandinavian background, the Waterside Workers Federation was disproportionately composed of Irish Catholics. It's going to become important for my next point. And it also elected communist leadership, who were clearly members of the Communist Party. Now, our data for this project comes from not only the kinds of interviews that I've told you about, that of course we can't interview everybody, 1930s, the last Seattle person who was in the 1934 strike died at the age of 95 2 weeks ago, so he sort of can't talk to him. Bridges is dead. But we do have an incredible archival record that we've been able to mine. We have archives of minutes for both the ILWU of all conventions and local meetings, for both the ILWU and the Waterside Workers Federation. We have pretty complete election data, both the national and local level. We know all the institutional rules that were in place and which ones were actually enforced and which ones weren't, and as well as the interviews. And now we're also doing a survey, but I'll come back to that at the end. It's not about the historical part, it's to take this into the future. So before I go into the explanation of the difference between the team, we'll use the Teamsters versus the truck drivers versus the dock workers, I should say one other thing before I tell you the factors that are not explanatory. One of the reasons that we chose, I chose those unions is that they all come from they're all transport sector unions, okay? So there's a similar kind of industrial logic to the work that they do. And as it turns out, and we know this from lots of historical record, they were basically drawing from the same population of strong white men, right? That was not particularly educated, not dumb, but not particularly educated white men. And in fact, we see lots of people who are members of one and then members of the other who move back and forth. It's a similar kind of job, in a sense, at least initially. Okay, what are the factors that are not explanatory of the differences between these two unions? One, as I've already emphasized, is ethnic background is not explanatory. There is one account of, if any of you are, you must have seen some of you On the Waterfront, the movie with Marlon Brando, okay. Well, that's the East Coast Longshore Union, right? And one of the very first scenes is the shape-up. And the shape-up is where everybody comes in. The term longshore actually comes because these were unemployed casual workers, and somebody would yell, "Everybody along the shore, come in," right? And these were homeless people sitting, lying on the beach, and they'd come in, and they'd come to the shape-up, where they'd say, "Pick me, pick me, pick me," or they'd grease the guy's palm, or they'd offer to babysit for his kids or do something. And he would say, "No communists, no this, no that. You're a union organizer, you're a troublemaker, not hiring you," right? So the walking boss, as he's called, had an amazing amount of power. And there was an immense amount of corruption and still is, it's still mafia-driven, in the East Coast Longshore Union. Now, one of the explanations for why the East Coast and the West Coast of the U.S. have evolved so differently was that the East Coast is composed of Catholics, members of the Union, and the West Coast of these good Scandinavians who care about social justice. That doesn't explain Australia, where you have good Catholics caring about social justice. Okay, so let's just get rid of the ethnic factor here as explanatory. Another possibility may be that only those who are already predisposed to social justice action joined the Longshore, and those against it joined the Teamsters. Well, we see very little evidence that people selected themselves into these unions on the basis of that kind of criteria. They took the job that was available. And we also have the Minneapolis example of the Teamsters, which was extremely radical, equally radical. This was a possibility that didn't come to fruition within that particular union. One possibility is that those who don't toe the line are made to leave. Well, that may be true in the Teamsters. It was certainly not true in the Longshore. Okay, so what's going on here? How do we explain it? Well, the first thing that has to happen is the establishment of a successful union. The union leadership succeeds in organizing people into a new form of union capable of collective action and strikes, and often industry-wide, which both the Teamsters ultimately achieved and the Longshore achieved. So whether you're socially committed or a business union, you gotta be able to be successful as a union. You've gotta be able to organize people, you've gotta be able to win strikes, you've gotta be able to win good collective bargaining contracts. Now, one of the differences that almost immediately emerges, though, we'll use Hoffa versus Bridges here, okay? Hoffa's a brilliant strategist, as was Beck. And they do win great contracts, and they do improve the material conditions of their workers in terms of hours, benefits, wages, and working conditions. But the dock workers go one further, at least on the West Coast and in Australia. They get rid of the shape-up. They get rid of that walking boss. They create a jointly employer-union-managed hiring hall. And that's one of the first things they demand and win in their new contracts. So they already go do something else, but it's obviously to serve the interest of the workers. But the hiring hall becomes a crucial institution. It's a place where interdependence is created, solidarity is created, people are out of the cold, they have a place to have coffee, to talk, to read newspapers, to meet with their leadership and hold them accountable, and as we'll see, to have other kinds of consequences in terms of rotation of work. So the second period is what kind of organizational culture gets created. So you win the contracts, you win the strikes, then you're a leader or a set of leaders, an executive committee that's been incredibly successful. And we know, just think about the founding fathers of the United States. That gives you a space to create a constitution, as it were, to create the rules of the game for how the organization is going to be run, right? And we see two very different things emerge at this point. So Hoffa, Beck, and their ilk create a very hierarchical organization, one in which the membership never votes directly on a contract, never votes directly for the leadership. It does it through representatives at the convention or an executive committee that it's elected. There are elections, but there's always a step removed. It's often got strong coercive elements involved in it. We know that the Teamsters are famous for threatening to break people's legs if they didn't join the union or go along with its policies, or worse. And this was not that it never happened in the Longshore workers, but this was not the policy or the enforced policy of the Longshore unions, of the dock workers unions. What the dock workers unions did under Healy and Bridges was to create a set of rules that were encouraged rank and file democracy, gave people, workers, the vote on the contracts and on their officers on a regular basis, had open conventions and open meetings at the local level that really determined policy, and had all kinds of other rules that basically constrained the leadership in order to increase its power of persuasion. So to recall the leader of either of the longshore unions that I studied requires only 15 people to sign a petition, and then you have a union-wide recall vote. There's no such rule in the Teamsters, okay?
I'll come back to some of those.
Okay, so they have these principles that they uphold. And they reproduce this culture with a leadership that continues to be successful in bargaining and winning gains, that upholds its principles that it's established, even when it's against the personal interest of the leadership. And it links the bargaining power of the union to its solidarity on issues unrelated to work. So by demonstrating that it'll close the ports over scrap iron, don't you think that makes the employers nervous? So that's not, I mean, if they'll do that over scrap iron, just think if we take one of their prerogatives away, what they'll do, okay? So it's a way of saying, look, if we're solidaristic, and if we show we care about all kinds of things, and we'll fight over things that don't even affect us, just think what signal that is giving to the employers about who we are and what we'll do. It also, of course, had the effect of empowering workers to believe that they have a right to ask for what they demand for themselves as well as for others. So the reproduction of that culture depended on those features, on this kind of leadership, on this link of solidarity to being effective in bargaining, and to the maintenance of a learning environment through the hiring hall, and work meetings, which are what they do in Australia, where during lunch breaks, people would learn things, and they'd learn about the news, and they'd learn about these issues that then would mobilize them and motivate them to act on them. There was lots of training in the Longshore Union to ensure, and still is, to ensure that leadership comes up from the rank and file, that it learns leadership skills, and that it learns about the economy, and the membership learns about the world. There was also, I should add, the improvement, one of the factors that maintained the culture in the Longshore and Dock Workers Union, is that hiring was increasingly done through networks. Being a son, a nephew, and ultimately a daughter or a niece of a longshore worker gave you an option to be a longshore worker. And that obviously helps to reproduce the culture. So over time, there was an increased self-selection. It helped the employers because the employers got people who knew what it meant to be a longshore worker in terms of the work, but it also helped the union reproduce its own culture with some detrimental effects, of course, because it meant that there was some exclusivity in terms of gender and less on race, because both unions were extremely good on racial issues. Okay. I want to talk a little bit more, let me get B up here, about the nature of the ILWU. These are two posters I'm going to show you first that the undergraduate students did, who we've had four or five teams of undergraduate students work on documenting the nature of the rank and file democracy in the ILWU. And in this, they're looking at it. They've gone through all of the convention proceedings of the ILWU, coded them, looked for controversies, written up the controversies, seen who initiated a particular policy, when the leadership won and when it didn't, and came away very convinced that this was a rank and file union. Okay. This is just another one and another year in which they're documenting these work. These posters have become incredibly important. They showed them in the undergraduate research symposiums, won awards for them. They're now bought by the unions as part of leadership training. They're hanging in union halls. They're hanging in pensioners' houses. Okay, here's cardinal principle number one of 10 principles, passed by the ILWU in 1953, codifying a principle that they'd had for a long time. And it's number one. The union is built on its members. The strength, understanding, and unity of the membership can determine the union's course and its advancements. The members who work, who make up the union and pay its dues, can best determine their own destiny. If the facts are honestly presented to the members in the ranks, they will best judge what should be done and how it should be done. In brief, it is the membership of the union which is the best judge of its own welfare, not the officers, not the employers, not the politicians, and the fair weather friends of labor. Above all, this approach is based on the conviction that, given the truth and the opportunity to determine their own course of action, the rank and file in 99 cases out of 100 will take the right path in their own interest and in the interest of all the people. Don't see language like that very often anymore, except in the ILWU. Okay, this is just to give you some sense at this point in the talk of who we're talking about. So this is not a terrific photograph, because if you could really see it, you would see that there are a lot of faces of color in this group. It's all male, but it's a very diverse group of males. And this is a convention meeting, lots of people there. This is Harry Bridges, who regularly met with the rank and file. My students edited this picture because he was always had a cigarette dangling from his mouth. And they thought they didn't want to show him with a cigarette because they didn't want to inspire young people to smoke. So they edited the cigarette out. That's why he's got this sort of funny expression there, because there's a cigarette dangling there. Every time I look at that picture, because I know what the real picture looks like. So he regularly came to all the locals and met with them, got yelled at for a variety of things, had these discussions, and you can see what the turnout is like. This is a wonderful tradition in the longshore called hitting the mic. So at conventions, some issue comes up, and suddenly you see all these people have been allowed to a convention once or twice. And suddenly you see all these people come up and line up at the mics that are in the middle. Try to get a group of students or a normal audience to do that. They want to have their say on this issue. Okay, so we did this incredible content analysis of the conference proceedings from 1938. We've now brought it up, actually, to 2004. And we've also analyzed some executive committee summaries that we got special permission to do. And that shouldn't be there. Okay. Got to do a little more editing here. I left my flash drive in Miami, so I had to reconstruct this, and I obviously failed to fully do that. Okay, so here is a comparison of these unions. The ILWU, the ILA, which is the East Coast Longshore of the US, the Teamsters, and the Waterside Workers Federation. Now, what we see is that none of them have a regular circulation of the top leaders. Somebody gets in power and they're either hold on to it or they're constantly reelected. Even Hoffa was reelected regularly, even in very clean elections. Even when it was shown that he had been stealing from the pension fund, he won the biggest election he'd ever won, and it was federally monitored. And that's in part because he really did win things for his memberships, and he was a very good patronage boss as well, sort of a old-fashioned boss. Corruption. No for the longshore workers in the West Coast and in Australia. Yes for the ILA and the Teamsters. communist leadership, yes for the longshore workers, no for the Teamsters and ILA. Minimally democratic, yes for all of them, but the ILA, that just means some kind of vote for officers. Tolerance of dissidents, again, we see the ILA and the ILW, I mean the Waterside Workers Federation and the ILWU being quite different on rank and file participation, on union hiring hall, union orientation. The ILWU gets expelled from the National Federation because it refused, when the CIO decided to kick out all the communists, or all the people who wouldn't sign a statement that they weren't communists, the ILWU refused to go along with that and was expelled from the Congress of Industrial Organizations. The ILA was expelled for racketeering from the American Federation of Labor, corruption, working with the mob. So was the Teamsters. The Waterside Workers Federation was a strong part of the Federation in Australia, the comparable Federation and of its Labor Party. All four were subject to various but different kinds of attacks by the national government. And only two of them, as I've said, were socially conscious. Now let me turn for a minute to one other aspect of these two unions that come out so differently, the Waterside Workers Federation and the ILWU. There's some institutions that they created in the early period and then maintained and developed as they reproduced their organizational culture that embodied and enforced the kinds of leadership principles that really came out of this kind of Marxist communist ideology that their leadership had. And there's been a very interesting study by Judith Stepan Norris and Maurice Zeitlin of all the unions in the US. It's called Left Out. And it finds that those unions that had communist leadership are disproportionately, overwhelmingly, the democratic unions by any definition of democratic. That, you know, we think of communists, I told you I would talk about this, that we think of communists as the Soviet Union. We forget about what the nature of the Communist Party was in the US and how it was a party, at least in the 1930s and 1940s, the sort of pre-Stalinist era or pre-consciousness of what Stalin was doing in the Soviet Union, that was one of the few sets of organizations in the country that was mobilizing people of color, that was committed to democratic practice in organizations all the way up through the government, and that was mobilizing labor unions. So it's not surprising that the socially committed unions also were communist in some sense. But there were some principles that came out of communism that became crucial for maintaining and reproducing the organizational culture of social commitment. One of the most important was equity at work. The use of the hiring, one of the things that the hiring hall was not just a place where people gathered, it was a place where people were given their work assignments. So instead of the shape up, they went to the hiring hall. And in both cases, in both of these unions, and not in the ILA, the principle by which work was distributed was on a rotation principle. So you had a right to a certain kind of job. There's a distinction among different kinds of jobs, and there are jobs that if you've had more seniority, you have a right to, or if you have certain skills, you have a right to. But within that subset, you got the job because you were the next person in line. And if you refused it, you went to the bottom of the list, okay? What that meant was that even during the Depression years or the recession years, that everybody in the union, or who had made it to the A level of the union, had a relatively equal pay with everyone else unless they chose not to by turning down particular jobs, which they might have done for any number of reasons. And it made sure that everybody had work, right? That there weren't some members of that group that didn't get work and some who did. One of the other principles of equity was that there were limits on the pay of the leadership, and there still are in these organizations. Think about CEO salaries in the US. Huge difference between the CEO salary and the highest paid normal employee in the company. Well, there was a difference, and there is a difference, in the ILWU and the Waterside Workers Federation, but I think the principle is like 2 times, not 2,000 times, or 1.6% of the highest. So they really, their salaries were tied to the worker salaries, and they never became significantly richer than the workers. And if they did, that was sort of a signal that there was corruption going on, right? That they were in somebody's pocket. They now sometimes get paid less. The international president sometimes gets paid less than a president of a local, because there may not be that same tie to the local president's salary. In terms of rank and file democracy, I've already told you about the easy recall, the free and open elections, the votes on contracts, and there was continually passage of constitutional provisions, such as that first principle that I read to you, that reaffirmed those commitments. The leaders implemented these principles even when it was against their short-term interests. If they did something the members didn't like, they could be unelected and go back to the ranks. And this was regularly happening, and that's part of why I'm studying locals as well as the national level, is it regularly happened in locals. People would be elected to leaders, they would do something the membership didn't like, even if it turned out to be something that worked for the members, they'd be unelected, then if it turned out it worked, they might get elected again. But it was leaders who committed and stayed consistent with their principles often took the chance of losing power. They, of course, had these limits on pay, and in many instances, and we see it particularly at the national level, they were willing to go to jail for their principles. Healy's second-in-command was regularly sent off to jail for various things that he committed to. Bridges was constantly going in and out of jail because of being accused of being a communist or one thing or another. But they were willing to do that because they believed in what they were doing. They permitted defeat on issues and implemented democratically determined policies even when the leaders didn't think they were the right thing to do. Harry Bridges led a strike and led it really well in the early 1970s when the workers felt that they hadn't gotten a good enough contract around the mechanization of the ports. It had already happened, the mechanization. This was a later contract. Okay. As I said, the leaders keep getting reelected. There's participation, so there's real evidence of contingent consent. Let me conclude, really, here by talking about what's happening now and whether that is continuing, whether these are being reproduced. Hopefully you can hear from what I've said that there's some things here that could translate into other kinds of organizations and other kinds of organizational cultures. But these unions have faced considerable change since they were developed in the 1930s. There have been lots of government attacks over time against the unions, which may have even raised the standing of the leaders during the McCarthy era. More recently, during the recent lockout by employers on the west coast of the US of longshore workers, Bush threatened to have an injunction against the workers. The workers weren't striking, the employers had locked them out, so they see Bush as an enemy here. There have been serious succession crises in these unions. Healy died suddenly in 1960 without somebody prepared to take his place. Bridges retired in 1977. And yet, the culture seems to be sustained without the original leaders. They've put in place a variety of institutional arrangements and commitments that seem to survive them. Probably the biggest shock to these cultures has been technological change, containerization, which has led to those big cranes on the ports and has reduced the size of the union considerably, right? Considerably. It's probably 10% of the size it used to be. I should have the numbers here, but I don't. Computerization is also having serious consequences. Young workers don't want to go to the hiring hall. They want to be called on their cell phone and told whether there's work or not. They don't see the advantage of the hiring hall and the kind of culture and solidarity it creates. The employers want to computerize work so that they can get rid of the hiring hall altogether. So those are real pressures. And there's also the argument that there might be less reason for unions today. We've passed various kinds of legislation and whatever that protect workers' rights and give them benefits in a different way. I don't particularly buy that, but that's an argument that's made too. So the ILWU is clearly, and the Waterside Workers Federation are clearly under stress. They're diminishing in numbers. There's less active participation than there used to be. I could show you the figures, but take my word for it. The hiring hall has become a less important place to gather. There's been a transformation of the way hiring, the way people get the job as longshore. It's not just through networks. It's now through a more randomized process, partially as an effect of a suit about gender discrimination against the union. But it remains a social movement union. It refused to load grapes, lacking the UFW, the United Farm Workers label, in the 1970s. It wouldn't unload the Neptune Jade in 1997 to support striking Liverpool workers. It closed the ports during the WTO protest in November, December 1999. I've already mentioned closing the ports about Mumia Abu-Jamal. And it most recently passed resolutions both in Australia and the US in opposition to the Iraq war. But as I said, it's going through changes. And in fact, when I mentioned that we're doing a survey now, we're actually got permission in Seattle and Tacoma to survey the new workers who are coming on the docks, who come in through this randomization process, and to do this survey in a panel way over time so that we can see whether they change the union or the union changes them. So let me conclude. I hope that I have indicated to you that something goes on in these organizational cultures that on the one hand may prevent people from acting on preferences that they might actually hold, and in other cases actually allows them to develop preferences that they might not have realized they had or realized were accessible for them, were feasible preferences, were realizable goals. And that this is done in part by an activation of norms and preferences that already exist. It's not so much that people are somehow persuaded, evangelized into doing something that isn't something that was already inside them, but that they learn enough and are given opportunities to act on their sense of justice and equity. It's activated, it's made real. And that's done in part by creating or changing their expectations, their beliefs, in game theoretic sense, about what it is both appropriate and possible to do, which is partially generated by the group and the organizational culture and the leadership that they're in. So if we can unravel these puzzles and identify these mechanisms in a union setting, I think it may improve our understanding of how people form their beliefs and expectations about what it is possible to do and what it is right to do, and that may lead to a greater capacity among more of us to act on our social justice energies. Thank you. So I can take some questions now, but I take it you have to come to a mic or something. I'll take students first. That's always my instinct, sorry.
Hi. My first question is about the concept of the socially committed unions being a part of this larger spin-off movement. I was wondering, looking at the longitudinal study, were there spikes in activism for socially conscious reasons during when time when the U.S. was also experiencing intense amount of activism? So during the 60s and 70s when we had new left movements, were the unions, were the longshore workers also engaged in more protests? Were they engaged in, were they feeding off of that generally national energy? And maybe they're seeing change elsewhere and then be inspired for change in their own industry.
That's a really interesting question that I'm going to write it down because I don't think we've systematically studied it. I can tell you what I think I know, but sometimes when you actually look at it, it looks a little different. There's no question that, you know, when there's a larger social movement, they're part of it, right? And that they feed off each other. But what's interesting to me about the Waterside Workers Federation and the ILWU is that they were often acting when almost nobody else was. They weren't really connected to students. I mean, the fact that we had to really work hard to get Longshore people to come to the university for events that we were putting on. The university is foreign territory to them. So the fact that students were organizing about farm workers was not something they particularly were cognizant of. They just knew there was this union out there, and Cesar Chavez had come and talked to them, and they knew that there was this problem that they had to act on. So there's something about, you know, they were generating some of these issues out of their own discussions, as well as, of course, being influenced by what was going on elsewhere. I mean, they're always at other kinds of demonstrations. I always see a big contingent of longshore workers at lots of other things. And there are other groups like that. So there's some playing off. I'll just have to check it. That's a good question. Peter.
My question is about what's transportable about the models that are successful here. It seems like there's a lot of it depends on the quality of the leadership, especially when these things get going. And to the extent that leadership is any sort of like innate quality at all, then that makes me sort of wonder whether there is a whole lot of transportability based on, you know, it just depends on whether you get the right person in the right place at the right time, I guess, about whether you can sort of build these things, because there does seem to be a certain institutional momentum that gets going that's successful, but when it comes time to get them going in the first place, it seems to depend a lot on particular people.
Another good question. That's absolutely true. Part of the argument here is that the quality of the leadership is very important, and the ideology of the leadership, the combination of the two. And so part of the study, and part of my larger study, part of what I addressed in my APSA, American Political Science Association presidential address, is that in a whole set of arenas, including the development of effective and good government, we need to understand the role of leadership much better than we do. My intuition, which is an informed one by a lot of social science research as well as by my own observations, is that the quality of leadership and the capacity of leadership is not just an effect of luck. I mean, there are those great people who come along who are at the right moment at the right time, but even them, if you think about a Gandhi or a Mandela, just to name two classic cases, don't just come out of nowhere. They just don't appear on the scene. They're affected by religious organizations they're in, or in Mandela's case, by the Communist Party, again, which he was involved with. Healy and Bridges didn't come from nowhere. They had, you know, they'd put in their time as rank and file members. They learned skills. They were trained by others, as well as bringing their own capacities. Nor were they acting individually. It wasn't just a question of a charismatic leader. It was a question of I'm using their names because you can't remember all the names I could give you. But in both cases, and in other cases that I've looked at, there's a whole group of people who are basically the leadership. It's not a single individual. So I think we need to give more attention to this problem about how you produce a leadership that has those capacities, has the kind of principled commitments that you need. It's an issue in firms and management as well. In fact, part of the model, when I give a really social science-y version of this, I talk about some economic models about so-called corporate culture that emerges in firms and the nature of the leadership that makes a difference between different kinds of firms and the kinds of commitments to workers or employees that provoke greater productivity. And again, they go to business schools. I mean, you know, they learn these things but bring their own qualities to them, and we're not eliciting those qualities out of our potential leaders, I fear. One more student, and then I'll come I know you have a question, Brenna.
I'm sorry, we're sort of monopolizing this row a bit here. First of all, thank you again for speaking with us tonight. I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more about sort of the how these workers were educated about particular social justice issues. Because I understand that, you know, that they were, and these were all these sort of factors that helped, you know, develop their openness to learning about them. But as far as actual pedagogical strategies are concerned, when you have a large collective of working class individuals who aren't educated very much, how do you explain these social justice issues in a format that they understand and that's something that's not going to overwhelm them? Like, how did they do that?
Interesting. There are a couple things to say. One, the issues, they didn't perceive them as particularly complicated, right? There's a right way and a wrong way to do this. You don't exploit farm workers. You don't put somebody to death who you don't, you know, for political reasons. You know, that's how they view it, right? You don't allow ships to go put down a people's rebellion, right? Black and white, simple. So it wasn't really complicated. It was more had to do with knowing that these things were happening and activating a sense of injustice about them or interpreting them a certain way, I guess. And they were their predilection was to interpret it that way because they're workers. So they had a sense of hierarchies of power, of exploitation, of people with the guns and with the clout trying to take advantage of those who didn't have it. So, you know, you're already feeding on that kind of background. In addition, I should add that we do find around the world disproportionately, but not, it's not always the case, but disproportionately, that longshore workers are more politically involved. And part of that is because they're internationalized by the nature of their trade. They're constantly dealing, you know, they rotate around the world. They're working with mariners and sea people and who've been in other places, and they learn about the world a little more. So they're a little more sensitized to the world in that sense, as a rule. There are some important exceptions to that, of course. So you've got that. But the final and most important thing was providing a space for learning. It wasn't so much the method of teaching, it was providing the opportunity in the hiring hall and in the stop work meetings where people could have discussions where they could have a chance to read the newspaper, right? We're talking the 30s and the 40s. In the early 50s, there were no televisions. So it was radio and newspapers and newsreels. But they would have lectures during their stop work meetings by someone who, you know, had an issue that they wanted to teach them about. So it was that kind of learning. I think you're next, actually, Brenda, and then we'll go here. You've waited patiently.
Oh, that's okay.
And then we'll go to a different row.
I'd like to hear from the students as well. And my question kind of follows up on what she was asking, and that was I wanted to hear a little bit more about space, because it seemed to me that resonating underneath all of the comments you've had and explanations of how this was evolving and working is the importance of space. And I think it's something that we here at Dickinson are also thinking about, and I hear faculty talk a lot and students talking a lot about space, and when we think about the Women's Center or an environmental center, having a place to go seems to be important. And I just was wondering if you'd talk a little bit more about how you view that, and especially in light of this issue with the cell phones and just call me on my phone when a job comes open and what that might mean, and how we might then apply that in our own environment for maintaining community and action.
Yeah, I do think space is important, but it was space that was building on interconnections that were happening through, in part, the nature of the work. And that's true in more than the longshore, where people have to work together, not just talk together, right? They get to know each other, they're interdependent with each other in terms of work. Now, containerization and mechanization change some of that with the longshore. It's still a team effort, but not the same kind of team effort that it used to be. The work groups are really very different. So it was the combination of having a space where you can talk about things, but also having that kind of interdependence so that you learn to rely on each other a little bit. But also having, those things. But, you know, those can be reproduced in a variety of ways. I mean, that you hear that space is important doesn't mean that it has to take exactly that form. There are lots of differences even between the two unions that were longshore and socially committed that I haven't elaborated, where the crucial thing was that they made their meetings important and meaningful, that they really had a participatory democracy, that they raised real issues at them that really mattered to people and invested people in those and got them geared up to come and talk about those issues, so that decisions were consequential at meetings. And that can certainly be reproduced. That can be reproduced in all kinds of political settings, especially if we can also create some possibility for people to interconnect with each other and have a sense of who each other is, which certainly happens at a place like Dickinson. I mean, it's small enough, people know each other, they recognize each other, they're in classes together, in dorms together, you know, see each other in the hub, wherever. So universities certainly have that capacity, many communities have that capacity, churches have that capacity. Some terrorist groups have that capacity in a negative way. I mean, there can be social commitments we don't like, right? They don't always have to, I've talked about some I personally like, but it could go the other way as well. So, you know, you really have to think about all the implications of this. But the crucial thing, at least for the ones that are develop these kinds of social justice commitments, is consequential decision making, I think.
I was just wondering if there's any sort of sense of the different types of unions' perspectives or perceptions of each other. So I think that we're saying that the kind of more socially conscious unions are better and kind of like one step above the more business-oriented unions. And I'm wondering if the business-oriented unions see it the same way or if their membership has any sense that they could be something more and that's something that they want to emulate, or if they think that they're really just getting kind of like the best bang for their buck in having, you know, to put in minimal time and receive the same personal benefits.
Okay, let's take the Teamsters as an example. It's a good question. Okay, so we have on record Jimmy Hoffa talking about Farrell Dobbs, who was the organizer of the Minneapolis Teamsters, and who was actually the person who figured out the organizing strategy that made the Teamsters the union that it is today. He taught Hoffa and he taught Beck, right? So he was the organizational genius that they then built on. And Hoffa said of Dobbs, "I don't get him. You know, why does he care about all these other things? All that matters is that you serve your constituents. You know, get them money, get them hours, get them wages, getting, what is all this other stuff? I just don't get it." And he said the same thing about Bridges. And Beck said the same thing about Bridges, that these are incredible organizers. They're incredibly effective. Why are they doing all this other stuff? Who cares? And what does that have to do with unions? So they didn't think that it needed, they didn't think they were lesser. They thought they were doing a great job. And frankly, they were doing a great job. I mean, let's be clear. Teamsters had nothing, and then they had a lot. Now they're very powerful, and they have lots of money, you know, for their work. But within the Teamsters, as within the longshore, there are people within the longshore union who think the social justice stuff is silly. And increasingly, there's a group of people who just don't get why they should pay any time or attention to those issues. It's heterogeneous in that sense. And certainly within the Teamsters, there's always been a group of people that have advocated a very different kind of union. I've given the historical example of Dobbs and the Minneapolis Teamsters. But we've seen the recent Teamsters for a Democratic Union movement that's been going on since the 1980s, and which really represents a very different way of thinking about how to be a Teamster, right? So it's a conflict between different images of unions. We're seeing a decline in the social movement unionism stuff. in part for the reasons I think that you were raising, that, you know, there's been a decline in social movements, and certainly in social movement unionism, period. Building a union isn't quite got the same form, except among the service employees, really, justice for janitors and some of those campaigns. So you don't see it so much. But no, it wasn't thought of as lesser. I mean, they didn't think of themselves as lesser for being business unions. They thought that was the right way to be, and the only way one should be. Okay, this row gets to ask questions now. You can't ask it together. You have to take turns.
I'm the English professor. I want to know the sad story of what happened to the Minneapolis crowd. Why did they collapse? What was the...
They didn't collapse. They were destroyed.
Who destroyed them, and how did they... How could they not resist their destruction? In other words, that seems like an interesting anomaly in this whole story of sort of the DNA of continuation. So I'm curious.
Well, they were a local within a larger union that had a very different organizational culture. And the president of the union, the international president, who's Tobin, hated them. They were creating trouble. They were stirring things up. They were trying to transform the culture of the union, and they wanted the union to be democratic, God forbid. And so he sent Hoffa after them. And Hoffa, they engaged in some action which was moderately illegal, the local, and the wrath of the state came down on them. The National Guard, the State Guard were called out. They were put in receivership, and Hoffa was put in charge. And Dobbs and the organizers were kicked out, and the troublemakers were told to shut up or have their legs broken or lose their jobs. Simple, coercive tactics. Scared a lot of other potential locals from following that path.
I was also wondering if you could comment on the issue of the living wage and how that's playing out on campuses. What particularly struck me was when you're talking about many of the longshoremen seeing some of these issues as being fairly simple. It was black and white. It had to do with basic rights. So I think about the living wage issue. On the one hand, that can be seen as fairly straightforward. In other ways, can also be mystified and complicated. And you can see certainly both ends of that spectrum. But I think it's relevant in many ways in terms of thinking about social activism and social justice and the ways in which that gets played out in pragmatic terms as well as rhetorically.
Well, I think, you know, there are two ways to talk about it. One is out of the context of the material that I've just been presenting. And it raises an issue that I didn't raise, so let me raise it here. If we think about the kinds of actions in which these unions have engaged, the social justice unions, they've really been of two kinds, I think. Maybe three, but let's make it two for the moment. One is actions that really do have to do with their wages, hours, and working conditions. The second kind, which is somewhat related, is, you know, on behalf of other workers, but not as a threat to their own employers, right? And then the kinds of social justice issues, which again, they care intensely about, but even not sending scrap iron. I mean, yes, they're closing down the ports, but it's not against the employers, it's against the state, right? It's against a policy of the government rather than a policy of the employers. So it's a different kind of issue about which they're seeing black and white about their own interest or black and white about others' interest that don't hurt them with their employer, right? So the living wage issue on campus has a slightly different quality than that. So it does already become a more complicated issue. Still, living wage campaigns are happening and have been happening, as you know, all over cities and municipalities, and more interesting for your purposes in terms of universities. And they are generally happening where there is not a union of certain workers within the university. So, and reasons to believe that the workers can't make a representation for themselves effectively for one reason or another. I don't really know what else to say about it without going into a whole riff about living wage campaigns. but they are, you know, I think they're spectacularly good thing for a university to have the campaign. The nature of the decision that gets made is a very complicated one, I think, because there are trade-offs about where the money is going to come from. So, you know, how far do you, what exactly do you, and how do you define a living wage? But to talk about, you know, what a university's mission is, what its obligations are to all the members of its community, can only be a good thing. You're going to have to tell me, manager, when.
The policy statement of 1953 that you showed, do you know whether this related, since it was 53, related to the McCarthy business?
Was it related to the McCarthy business? Is that what you were asking?
In response, or? It's just such a magic year.
You know why it was done then? Yeah, I think in part it was a reaffirmation. It had actually been a principle all along. It was one of the 10 founding principles. So it had been verbalized in a variety of ways, but it's recommitted to and put in the Constitution in 1953. And that is about the time when the screening controversies and the Red Scare and the CAIO requiring people to sign that they weren't members of the Communist Party. So I think you're right. I mean, I'll have to look into that. But I hadn't thought about the moment of this recommitment, and I think it does have to do with that we're going to tell people who we are, not anybody else. Nobody else is going to tell us what to do.
And I had a question about space. You mentioned that the sit-down areas in the Union Hall, and did the Teamsters have a sit-down place?
No.
There's a personal reason I ask that.
They have halls.
Pardon me?
They have union halls, but they don't. The thing about a hiring hall is that in order to get the work, you have to go there. Mm-hmm. So if you go to the morning assignment, which I've done quite recently, they happen at 5 or 6 in the morning, and people are coming in, and they're saying hello to everybody, and they're talking about politics of the union and politics of stuff, and then they go get their assignment, and then they go back and chat for a while, and then they all go off to work. So nothing, you know, they're union halls where people can go hang out a bit, but without that same kind of quality of really requiring everybody to come in pretty regularly and interact with each other.
The one reason I ask that is the Musicians Union in New York City, where the real estate is terribly expensive, as everybody knows. There was no place to sit down. Actually, it was a ballroom at night, and the union's offices were upstairs in the building, and the officials of the union were very detached from the membership. Probably one of the most detached. But I was just wondering, because there was never any place for anybody to sit down and talk about anything. It was go in and talk about rustle up work or whatever.
Right. Well, most unions in this country are basically business agents meant to negotiate, you know, and the union doesn't have any, the members pay their dues, but they're there to the union.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for questions. However, I would like to thank Margaret Levy for her participation in tonight's event and present her with a token of our appreciation.
Well, thank you. Look at this, that beautiful poster. Thank you very much. Great. Thank you, Whitney.